Mrs. Hilda Rumpole to Dorothy Dodo Mackintosh. My dear Dodo, this is the story Rumpole will never tell. It's not at all how he would wish to present himself to his audience, his readers, his ladies and gentlemen of the jury, in the many accounts he has written of his brilliance down at the Old Bailey, and his particular cleverness at enabling assorted scamps and scallywags to escape their just deserts. Such work Rumpole sees as protecting the liberty of the subject, Magna Carta and the presumption of innocence, and he assumes a look of injured nobility when I tell him that he has become little more than an honorary uncle to the Timpson family, that infamous clan of South London villains whom Rumpole, when under attack, says I have to rely on for my scanty housekeeping allowance. Rumpole also prides himself on his worldly wisdom, and the fact that he can see further through a brick wall than anyone else in the legal profession. The entire bench of judges, including the Lord Chancellor, the Master of the Rolls, and the Lords of Appeal in Ordinary. My reason for writing this account, entirely for my own consumption, and yours, Dodo, as my oldest school friend, and one who has seen the best and the worst of Rumpole at quarters which may have been from time to time uncomfortably close, is to show that in the case of R. versus Skelton, I certainly saw further through a brick wall than he could without having passed a single bar exam. I pulled off a coup to equal his in that case which he never tires of telling us about, the Penge Bungalow murders. Rumpole is, I have to tell you, Dodo, a bit of an actor. I don't think you've ever seen him in court, with his grey wig askew, dirty when he bought it second hand from the ex-Attorney General of the Windward Islands, and now even dirtier after 50 years of contact with Rumpole's glistening forehead. His gown tattered, he never asks me to mend it, and his waistcoat gravy-stained. He seldom allows me to take it to the smarty-pants cleaners, who give a pretty reliable service in the Gloucester Road. He is, of course, acting the part of an inadequately paid and outspoken rebel against authority. And when he's at home, and you've seen this, my dear old Dodo, many times, he is acting the part of a free spirit imprisoned, through no fault of his own, in marriage, just as the clients in his less successful cases are banged up in Wormwood Scrubs. Dodo, I don't know if you remember the case of Michael Skelton. There was a good deal about it in the Daily Telegraph at the time, but I know you object to the amount of quite gratuitous violence there is in crime reporting these days, and perhaps you were too busy with your splendid watercolours to notice it. Your Lamorna Cove on a wet afternoon hangs over the gas fire as I write, and I can feel the dampness rising. We all know that young people have got quite difficult lately. Since our Nick went off to teach in Florida and married his Erica, we have hardly been close. But quite honestly, Dodo, families have got to learn to live together. And although no one knows better than you how completely maddening Rumpole can be at times, it's impossible to imagine Nick ever being tempted to beat his father to death with a golf club, the crime which the Skelton boy was up for. I mean, it simply isn't the way youngsters from nice homes carry on. You can imagine the poorer sort of people doing it, people on drugs and income support and such like, although I can't really imagine them having golf clubs available in their entrance halls. But young Michael Skelton seemed to have nothing in the world to complain about. His father, Dmitry Skelton, was a very successful surgeon. I believe there was Russian blood in the family somewhere, and although I can connect the Russians with violence, they don't seem, in the course of history, to have played much golf. Just a passing thought, Dodo. Anyway, the father did cosmetic surgery, I think they call it, which means giving other rich people better bosoms or more youthful faces. I don't know. You and I have lived quite comfortably with our faces since we were a couple of new bugs, all wet around the ears at Chippenham. And as for Rumpole's face, it seems to me it is quite beyond repair, only fit for demolition. I might think sometimes, but I wouldn't say it aloud, Dodo. Apart from the various acts he puts on, he can be quite a sensitive soul at times, and I don't wish to cause him pain, unless it's absolutely necessary. Well, as I was saying, this business of yanking up people's bosoms and tightening their cheeks had provided the Skeltons with an extremely nice converted farmhouse in Sussex, with a marble swimming pool. There were colour pictures in the Weekend Telegraph. A jacuzzi, 4 cars in the garage, and all the trimmings, which we tell each other we wouldn't want, but might quite like if we found them provided for us. Having been sent to Lancing and then to Cambridge to study medicine and follow in his father's footsteps, or should I say his father's wrinkles, Dodo, if you will forgive a small joke on a serious subject, the boy should have been grateful, or, if he couldn't have managed that, at least not beat his father about the head with a favourite driver. Late one afternoon, could it have been last July? Anyway, I know it was still light. I came home from my bridge lesson with Marigold Featherstone. She's Lady Featherstone, you know, the judge's wife, and we both suffer from extremely irritating husbands. Of course, she's not an old friend like you, Dodo. Marigold and I were never together as new bugs at Chippenham. Well, when I got back to Froxbury Mansions, I found Rumpole home surprisingly early. An urgent conference in Pomeroy's wine bar, over a bottle of Chateau Fleet Street, usually takes up at least 2 hours at the end of his working day. He had his jacket and waistcoat off, and sat in his braces and shirt sleeves, in a flat with closed windows, where you might have roasted a chicken without the help of the gas oven. "You seem to be enjoying that brief, Rumpole," I said as I forced open a reluctant window. "Even more than a bottle of your usual third-rate red wine. Are you planning to freeze me to death before I can pull off what promises to be one of my most sensational defences?" he asked in a plaintive sort of voice. "If you're cold," when in dealing with Rumpole you have to be merciless, "there's always your cardigan. Don't tell me you found another Penge bungalow murder." "Penge bungalow? What was that exactly?" "I tell you, R versus Skelton is going to outdo the fame of all my previous triumphs. This is a case which will go down in history. I envisage a final speech lasting at least a day." "Why will you be giving the final speech, Rumpole?" "Because, needless to say, I am doing this case, as I did that rather more trivial affair of the Penge bungalow, alone and without a leader." "Is that because all the leaders realize that Michael Skelton has simply got no defense?" "It's because my instructing solicitor knows that I am a far greater defender than all those self-important amateurs who wrap themselves in silk gowns and flaunt the initials QC after their names." "And who is your instructing solicitor?" I asked, to put an end to a speech which, after a lengthy marriage to a permanent non-QC, I could repeat by heart. "Some owner of a South London bucket shop. Cut-price defences in hopeless murder cases offered to close friends of the Timpson family." "What nonsense you do talk, Hilda," Rumpole sighed heavily. "My instructing solicitor happens to be Daniel Newcombe. To those of us who know him well and undertake his more difficult cases, he will always be Danny Newcombe." "And who is this Danny, anyway?" It seems extraordinary to me now, Dodo, that there was ever a time when I had to ask such a question. "Hilda, I know you are a complete innocent when it comes to the law, but Newcombe, Pouncefoot and Delaney are quite the grandest firm dealing in criminal matters. Danny is the senior partner. I believe that with me in command, his firm may pull off something sensational." "You mean get a boy off who murdered his father?" "Who is alleged to have murdered his father." "I don't suppose you'd get Nick off if he'd beaten you to death with a golf club." "If he's beaten me to death, I'd scarcely be in a position to stand up and defend him." Rumpole had the intolerable expression he puts on when he thinks he said something clever, so I ignored this and opened another window. And by the way, Danny's invited me to dine with him at the Sheridan Club next Thursday. He said he wanted to get to know me better. If that's what he wants, he'd be better off talking to me. At least he'd get an unbiased opinion. Oh, you're coming too. You mean he's invited me? And do bring your lovely wife. I assume it was you he had in mind. But Rumpole, you hate going to dinner at the Sheridan Club. You say it is full of pompous bores and... Hilda, we all have to make sacrifices if we are to rise to the top in the legal profession. And for the sake of a brief from Newcombe, Pouncefoot and Delaney, I would willingly rent a dog collar and go to dinner with the Archbishop of Canterbury. My God, there's a wind whistling round my knees that must have come straight from the Ural Mountains. I told you, Rumpole, if you're feeling cold, then go and put on warm clothing. He left me then, his lips forming those syllables which I had come to understand, spelt out, "She who must be obeyed." I'm sorry to drag you to my club, which I'm afraid you'll find desperately dull, Hilda. My excuse is we need girls like you to lighten the old place up occasionally, don't we, Horace? Danny fished the bottle of Chablis out of the ice bucket and considerately refilled my glass when I was only halfway through the potted shrimps. I really don't know. I think it was the first time I'd known Rumpole short of an answer to a question. I'm not a member here. Not a member here? Danny seemed genuinely surprised. We must do something about that. Or are you against Horace joining the Sheridan, Hilda? Do you want to keep an eye on him at home? I wouldn't mind in the least. Life at home's far more peaceful without him. That's provided he can spare time from his other port of call. What's that? Pomeroy's wine bar. I don't know it, I'm afraid. Danny smiled. But it sounds interesting. I felt a sudden affection for a lawyer who'd never heard of Pomeroy's. Is that white burgundy all right for you? He was asking Rumpole, with what I thought was admirable consideration. To which my husband replied, if you can believe this, Dodo, thanks. If you're asking, I'd rather have a slurp of the red. A couple of slurps, if that's at all possible. I suppose I should count myself lucky that Rumpole and I don't go out to dinner very much. When the red wine came, Rumpole said thoughtfully, from the photographs, it's obvious there'd been a hell of a fight in the hall. The grandfather clock was knocked over and stopped at 10:45. You noticed that, of course. Horace, please. We didn't come here to talk shop. Danny put a hand on his counsel's sleeve, and I noticed how clean and well manicured his fingernails were, something you could hardly say for Rumpole. We came here to get to know each other. There are some pretty dusty old members here, Hilda, but we do boast of quite decent pictures. There... He turned to look at the portrait of a man in a wig, smiling in what I thought rather a condescending way over the mantelpiece. Richard Brinsley himself, a true wit like you, Horace, and a man of many love affairs. Not like Horace, I thought. I began to wonder about Danny. I must confess, Dodo, he seemed a great deal more interesting than any other lawyer I'd met. He had come alone, and there had been no mention of a Mrs. Newcombe. Later, I remember him saying that he had dreaded going back to his empty flat. Since I lost Deirdre, it's been lonely. I mean, you can't have much of a conversation with the television. Television is full of discussion programs, but you can't discuss anything with it. It's not like a wife, it never answers back. When Danny said this, I had to fight a curious impulse to put my arm round his shoulder to cheer him up. But of course I couldn't do that. Not in the Sheridan Club. Not with Rumpole sitting there slurping his claret and asking a really charming Indian waiter if he had anything remotely resembling a toothpick about him. At the weekend, Rumpole and I went shopping in Safeways. I'd honestly rather he'd stayed at home, but he'd become strangely attentive since our dinner at the Sheridan and had insisted on coming with me. to help lug the heavy stuff. As I wandered round the shelves, I have to tell you, Dodo, I wasn't even comparing prices. I was shopping in a kind of dream. I couldn't help thinking of Danny, whom I no longer thought of as Mr. Newcombe. I wondered how old he might be, and thought he was timeless. Anything from the late 50s to the early 70s. His skin was a healthy pink, and as free from wrinkles, apart from laugh lines around the eyes, as it would have been if Skelton's father had been at it, which I was quite sure he hadn't. His eyes had a strange brilliance, an almost unearthly blue, I remembered as I reached for a tin of pineapple chunks, which turned out to be Japanese bean shoots when I got them home. Danny's eyes were as blue as the clearest of seas on the sunniest of days. No reflection, Dodo, on the wonderful way you painted a wet afternoon in Lamorna. I thought about the well-cut tweed suit, the highly polished brogues, the silk handkerchief in the breast pocket, and the slight whiff of some completely masculine eau de cologne. And I thought of the way he leant towards me, one ear always turned in my direction, seriously interested in anything I might have to say. And then I saw Rumpole come padding towards me down the long alleyway between the fancy breads and the pet food, wearing his weekend uniform of a woolen shirt and cardigan, tubular grey flannels, and battered hush puppies, worn with the feet turned distinctively outwards. He shouted at me from some distance. "Blood, Hilda. I've been thinking about blood." "Stop making an exhibition of yourself, Rumpole. Everyone can hear you." I rebuked him in my most penetrating whisper as soon as he was in earshot. "You know why Michael Skelton didn't want to be a doctor like his father? Young people nowadays are always trying to be different from their parents. It was the blood. He couldn't stand the sight of blood." "Well, some people are squeamish, Rumpole. We all know you're not squeamish about anything. Now, have you achieved that simple little list I gave you?" "Of course I have. Perfectly painless business shopping, if you've got a system. I can't imagine why women make such a song and dance about it." At the checkout, he returned to his favourite subject. "The hallway was covered in blood. Splashes on the walls, pictures, everything in sight. I see you forgot the washing powder, Rumpole, and I said frozen potato chips, not potato cakes. Is that the result of your wonderful system?" The girl at the till was looking a little green, and I wanted to shut my husband up. Bloodstains are not the thing to talk about on a Saturday morning in Safeways. "How would a boy who couldn't stand the sight of blood commit a murder? Poison, perhaps? An electric fire dropped in the bath, even? Hire a contract killer, and he wouldn't have had the embarrassment of taking any part in it. Surely the last thing he'd choose is the way they deal with pigs in an abattoir." "Rage, Rumpole," I told him, "can drive people to forget squeamishness. Now give me the list and I'll finish off the shopping properly." "How would you react, Dodo, to being called a girl? I'm quite sure Ms. Liz Probert, the young radical lawyer in Rumpole's chambers, would have found it patronizing at best, and probably deeply insulting. And yet we were girls, weren't we, Dodo, when we passed notes to each other in the back row during Gertie Green's French lesson, or when we used watercolours as experimental makeup in the art room? I don't know how it is with you, but I don't feel that we've changed much over the years. A little stiffer when I wake up, perhaps. A lot more weight to push up off the sofa and a few hopes dashed. Do you remember when I made a desperate plan to marry Stuart Granger? I was going to bump into him one morning quite casually during the Christmas holidays where that awful little show-off Dorothy Bliss told us, quite erroneously, he lived at the time. So far as I remember, Dodo, you were after James Mason. So you've ended up unmarried, and I'm landed with Rumpole. And sometimes I find myself wondering which of us is more lonely. But I think we're still girls at heart. Time has never robbed us of that. And when Danny called me one in the Sheridan, I felt, to be quite honest with you, nothing but pleasure. All the same, it was a huge surprise as the telephone rang one morning, when I was looking forward to keeping myself company in Froxbury Mansions, and some secretary's voice said, "Mrs. Rumpole, I've got Mr. Daniel Newcombe on the line." "It must be some mistake. Mr. Rumpole's in court, and..." She told me there was no mistake. He'd asked for Mrs. Rumpole particularly. I was surprised, Dodo, and even more surprised when I found myself alone with Danny at a corner table at the Brasserie San Quentin. And Danny, who had a meeting with clients in Knightsbridge, a millionaire from Kuwait, who he told me was accused of pinching nighties from Harrods, was pouring out Beaujolais for me. He had a double-breasted suit on this time, and gleaming black brogues instead of brown, and some regimental or old-school tie, and the same bright blue eyes glittered at me. "Bit of luck," he said. "You happen to be free." "It wasn't luck at all. I'm free nearly always." "And your husband's in court." "Luckily. When he isn't, you'd think there'd been a death in the family." "And when he's busy, it's because there's been a death in someone else's family." This was rather neatly phrased, don't you think, Dodo? "Oh, he doesn't always do murders. It's usually thieving or something or other indecent. Murder is a rare treat for Rumpole. Of course he's full of himself because you decided to let him do Skelton alone and without a leader." I didn't want the jury to think Michael's a poor little rich boy. Danny looked at me, and I saw the wrinkles at the corner of his blue eyes. If I'd had a top QC, they'd have said, "That's what he does with his father's money. Your husband, with his gravy stains and torn gown, might make the good citizens of East Sussex feel quite sorry for the lad." "Is that the reason?" "I'm sure I can be honest with you, Hilda." "I'm sure you can, but I don't think I'll tell Rumpole." "It might be more tactful not to." I don't know why I felt a sort of excitement then, Dodo. It wasn't only because I was drinking wine in the middle of the day, something I never do. It was, I'd better admit it, because Danny and I were sharing a secret, something which Rumpole would never know. I mean, to put it far more bluntly than he'd have liked, it seemed he had been chosen because of the state of his waistcoat. Rumpole seems to have found a defence. Good for him, I've been racking my brains. Apparently Dimitri Skelton was desperate for Michael to become a surgeon. Naturally the father wanted his only son to follow in his footsteps. Didn't Rumpole's son... Oh, Nick had seen quite enough of the law to put him off it forever. It seems that Michael Skelton almost fainted at the sight of blood. So he told me. So how, Rumpole's going to ask, could he have committed such a blood-stained murder? Danny didn't answer my question, or Rumpole's question, for a while, but when he did, he was still smiling. I suppose money overcomes a lot of finer feelings. A terrible lot of money. You mean about 3 million in the estate? New faces can be expensive. And the profits from the beauty treatment had been cleverly invested. So it wasn't just a quarrel about the boy's career. More serious than that. Dimitri's wife died of cancer 5 years ago. It seems he never got on with her family. Michael was his sole heir. He stood to gain a huge amount of money from his father's death. That's the big hurdle Rumpole's got to get over. I don't envy him that, however much I envy him other things. I can't imagine what sort of other things. Like your companionship. I have to say, Dodo, I found Danny's answer strangely disturbing. By the way, Hilda, he went on in quite a businesslike way to cover my confusion, I've got seats at Covent Garden next Thursday, if you happen to have a free evening. Underneath these granite crosses, no one counts their gains and losses, but they whisper underground all the answers they have found. How else can our quarrels end, our enemy become our friend? The dead around us all reply, "Peace be with you, you must die. What's that, Rumpole, poetry? Hardly. Not really poetry. Not the sort of stuff that gets into the Oxford Book of English Verse, the Quiller Couch edition. I thought it was quite good. At least it rhymes. Who wrote it? It's called In a Sussex Graveyard by Michael Skelton. He's a poet. He wants to be. His father wanted him to be a plastic surgeon. Personally, I don't believe he was suited to either profession. If you're going to be a poet, you've got to be able to stand the sight of blood. This was one of Rumpole's epigrams, or bon mots, as Gertie Green used to call them, Dodo. So, as you may imagine, I ignored it. I was more than a little irritated by him. He had a load of new instructions open on the kitchen table, so I could hardly get at my chops and mash. And he was slightly above himself, as he always is after he's been to see a customer in prison in an important case. And he seemed to regard his day trip to Sussex as something of a day out. A strange young man, Hilda. He seems to think that because he writes poetry, he exists in a world of his own, rather above ordinary mortals. Can you believe it? He hardly bothered to answer my questions. He didn't seem nervous or frightened or even especially concerned about the case. Just bored by it. But he's wrong, you know. In my opinion, poetry is written by people who live quite ordinary lives and have a way with words. Golden lads and girls all must, as chimney sweepers come to dust. The man who wrote that went to the pub and worried about his bank account. You must be a poet then, Rumpole. You spend enough time in Pomeroy's wine bar. Was that another bit of young Skelton? No, another bit of old Shakespeare. You know, Dodo, English lit was never my strongest subject, but Rumpole needn't have sounded so patronising. You're not telling me this boy killed his father because he wanted to be a poet, are you, Rumpole? I'm not telling you he killed his father, full stop. That is a fact which still has to be decided by 12 honest citizens of East Sussex. I gave a heavy sigh, signalling that I'd heard quite enough of Rumpole on the burden of proof to last a lifetime. Then I said, I should think he probably killed his father for the money. Hilda, have you accepted a brief for the prosecution? Well, he was his father's sole heir, wasn't he? And I don't suppose cosmetic surgery comes cheap. In my anxiety to put Rumpole down, I had said rather more than I intended. How did you know that? Rumpole gave me his sharp cross-examiner's look. I really can't remember. Hadn't the mother died and Michael was the only child? It said that in the Daily Telegraph. It's not quite true that he's the sole heir. Rumpole ferreted about among his papers for a copy of the will. Skelton left £100,000 to his secretary, an attractive girl, Michael tells me, and all the rest and residue of my estate to my son, Michael Limington Skelton, or, if he should predecease me, to my cousin, Ivan Limington Skelton, now resident in Sydney, Australia. Well, Michael didn't predecease him, did he? Otherwise he wouldn't be defending him. Oh, Hilda, what a wonderful grasp of legal principles you have. It was at moments like these that I was strongly tempted to tell Rumpole why he'd been chosen to defend young Skelton, alone and without a leader. However, I contented myself with saying, I don't really know what kind of defence you've got. The grandfather clock. Rumpole produced the photograph of the blood-stained hall. Stopped at 10:45. I told you that was important. Why? Michael's got an alibi for 10:45. Really? What is it? That poem. He was walking in the beech woods, about half a mile from the house, composing it. But you said it wasn't even a good poem. Or convincing evidence in itself. But there were witnesses.
Who?
New Age travellers. That's what they call themselves. Sort of politically correct gypsies. They were camping in the woods, and Michael stopped to talk to them. He even recited his poem to them, so they might remember him. So have you found these gypsies? Not yet. But today, after we'd seen Michael in Lewis jail, old Turnbull took me for a walk to the beech woods near Longacre, the Skeltons' home. Who's Turnbull? Newcomb's clerk, or legal executive, I think that's what they call themselves now. I really don't know what you find so funny, Hilda. Just the thought of you going for a walk in any sort of wood. One has to make sacrifices for all important murders. We found some tire marks, the remains of a sort of campfire, and an old shirt bearing the legend, Lesbians with Attitude. Talking of Danny Newcomb, Rumpole... I wasn't. I was talking of his clerk. Danny's invited me to Covent Garden next Thursday. He didn't think you'd care for the opera. Opera? Isn't that the stuff Claude Erskine Brown takes young legal ladies to when he's trying to get off with them? No, Danny's damn right. I wouldn't care for it. I'd rather be stuck before Mr. Injustice Graves on a 6 months post office fraud. But why on earth has he asked you, Hilda? I think, Rumpole... The time had come to take his mind off his murder case and give him something serious to worry about. That Danny Newcomb has taken a bit of a shine to me. There was a short silence, and then Rumpole said, "The first thing Danny Newcomb's got to do is find those New Age travellers." At that moment, he didn't seem to give a hoot whether his instructing solicitor had taken a shine to me or not, and quite honestly, Dodo, I decided to proceed accordingly. Well, there I was in the crush bar at Covent Garden Opera House, which I had often heard about but never been crushed in before. It was the first interval, and I had sat for an hour and a half in the great gold and plush of the place, letting the music wash over me, and getting little clue about the story from the words which occasionally flickered on a screen over the stage. I couldn't really understand what the fuss over Don Giovanni was all about. He was a shortish, stout person who sweated a good deal, and I would be prepared to say that as a lady killer he didn't rank far ahead of Rumpole. I had bought something new and blue for the occasion from Debenhams, and by an amazing coincidence... Danny was also wearing a dark blue suit with a cornflower-coloured tie, which made him look younger, and went stunningly with his eyes. There, at least, I thought, as he came towards me with two glasses of champagne, was a man who might have made 1,003 conquests in Spain. "This is a great treat for me," he said as he handed me a glass clouded by the iced wine. "My favourite opera with a truly sympathetic companion." "A treat for me," I told him, "to be in a theatre without having to give Rumpole a quick dig with my elbow every time his eyes start to close and the heavy breathing threatens to begin." "I hope he doesn't mind our going out together." "Not at all. He's perfectly happy to be left at home with your murder." "Oh, dear. Is he boring you to death with that?" "I do get rather a lot of the Skeltons. When I was trying to eat my supper the other night, he insisted on reading out the father's will." "Was that interesting?" "Not really. Rumpole seemed surprised to discover that Michael wasn't the only person to benefit." "Oh, you mean the Aussie secretary. We checked up on her. She had gone to a girlfriend's birthday party in Wimbledon and spent the night there. She was celebrating until she went to bed around 2 in the morning. Anyway, I doubt if she'd be much of a hand with a golf club. You know, looking round this bar, I can see a good many people I've acted for when they were charged with various offences. They all look extremely prosperous, and, of course..." "And what?" I asked when he hesitated, smiling. "Envious, that I'm with such a charming companion. Oh, good evening, Judge." We were joined, not by one of Danny's clients, but by a woman sent to try them, Mrs. Justice Phillida Erskine Brown, always known to Rumpole, who for many years had had the softest of spots for her, as the Portia of his chambers. In her wake trailed her husband, Claude Erskine Brown, now a QC. You will remember, Dodo, that he only achieved what Rumpole calls queer customer status when his wife was made up to a scarlet judge, adding beauty and an unexpected degree of serenity to the bench. Hilda Rumpole and Mr. Newcombe. Good heavens! Her ladyship delivered judgment. It is a surprise seeing you two here together. Hilda had a free evening, and I was happy to introduce her to my favourite opera. I'm afraid it's not my favourite Leporello. Claude Erskine Brown looked as though he'd been invited to a feast and offered a damp sausage roll. Quite the worst non volo più severe I've ever heard at the Garden. But of course you're not usually listening so carefully, are you, Claude? You're usually far more interested in whomever you happen to have invited. Isn't that true? The judge accompanied her question with a sort of humourless laugh, and I remembered that she'd learnt the art of cross-examination from Rumpole. "How's the Skelton case going?" Claude asked Danny, with, I thought, ill-concealed anxiety. "I only ask because my diary's getting pretty full since I took Silk." "Oh, I think Danny's going to leave R versus Skelton to Rumpole." I spoke as a person with inside knowledge. "He's not taking in a leader." "Can that be right?" Claude looked seriously concerned, but his wife said, "Not a bad idea, that. Rumpole's always at his best in a hopeless case." "But he'll start attacking the police. He'll try to destroy all the prosecution witnesses. They won't like that sort of thing in East Sussex." Claude moved closer to Danny in a vain attempt to sell his forensic talents, as though they were double glazing, and Phillida leant forward and asked for a word in my ear. They were a few words, and they came as a question. "Don't tell me you're going out with Danny Newcombe." "Well, isn't it obvious?" "Is it? We're not exactly sitting at home watching television, are we?" "But you mean you're actually going out with him?" "Yes, of course. Well, we've only actually done it twice." There was what I believe is known as a pregnant pause, and then Phillida said, "And Rumpole doesn't know?" "Well, he knows about the opera. I haven't told him about the other thing. I had, you will remember, Dodo, kept quiet about the Brasserie San Quentin." The judge gave me a long look of deep concern and said, "I promise you, Hilda, your secret is absolutely safe with me. And if Claude starts blabbering, I'll do him for contempt of court." Before she could explain this urgent but mysterious message, the interval was over and the bell called us to the further adventures of the Don, who, in my honest opinion, Dodo, couldn't hold a candle to Danny Newcombe in the lady-killing department. In the second interval, we saw Phillida and Claude together in the distance, talking to each other with unusual vivacity and studiously avoiding looking in our direction, as though we were tedious relations they hoped they need have nothing further to do with, or people suffering from a contagious disease. I might have taken some offence at this, Dodo, but I was too busy listening to what Danny was saying to me. Although his eyes were still bright and smiling, his voice had become low and unusually serious. He looked at me, Dodo, in what I can only describe as a yearning sort of way, and said, "Sometimes I long for a complete change in my life." "I'm sure we all do. I'd love to give up the legal treadmill, go away to the sunshine, perhaps with new companions or a new companion. You know what, Hilda?" "No, what?" Quite honestly, Dodo, I was feeling quite weak at the knees, and I'm quite sure it wasn't the champagne when he said, "'Tis not too late to seek a newer world." I couldn't look at him, Dodo. I glanced across at the judge and her husband and caught them turning hurriedly away. Then I stared down into my glass of champagne and knocked the rest of it back. My mouth was full of air bubbles, which made me suddenly speechless, which may have been just as well. Push off, and sitting well in order smite, The Sounding Furrows. Danny went on, and I realized that he was reciting poetry, as Rumpel does at important moments. I don't know what you'd have thought, Dodo, but I was quite sure that the words contained some sort of an invitation. Then we were summoned to see the last bit of the opera, where the general statue comes to supper, and the unfortunate lady's man is sent down to hell. Some nights later, the scene was far less exciting. Rumpel and I were sitting either side of the gas fire in Froxbury Mansions, and I thought I'd discover whether he was noticing me or not. So I asked, "What are those photographs, Rumpel?" "Oh, nothing very sensational." His brief in Skelton was spread out on the floor around him. Pictures I got Turnbull to take in the woods. The remains of the gypsy encampment. I'm getting Newcombe to advertise any New Age travellers who met a young man who read poetry to them at about 10:45 on the night of the 12th of May. I thought he should put it in Time Out, The Big Issue, and the East Sussex Gazette. Can you think of anything else politically correct gypsies might read? I'd no idea what gypsies read. I went back to the Daily Telegraph crossword, but Rumpel was in an unusually communicative mood. "I had the most extraordinary conversation with Claude Erskine Brown," he told me. "By the way, he's prosecuting me in Skelton. Graves is coming down to try it." "I thought Claude was busy angling to lead you." "Did you hear that at your bridge lesson?"
"Yes."
It was very strange, Dodo, how quickly I took to telling Rumpel some untruths. Well, Danny wouldn't brief him, but Ambrose Crump, who was prosecuting, went off with jaundice and Claude got the brief. "Oh, yes, and he's leading Ms. Liz Probert. She'll know what paper New Age travellers take in. I'll have to ask her. Anyway, Claude and I were chatting about the case, and he suddenly said, 'Philly and I are tremendously sorry for you, Rumpel.' "'Why on earth did he say that?' I asked, knowing the answer. "'That's what I asked him. I told him I'd done far more hopeless cases than Michael Skelton, and I thought I'd been able to put up with the funereal graves in the past, and the old death's head had no further terrors for me. Furthermore, having Claude for the prosecution was always a distinct plus for the defence.' "'How very kind of you, Rumpel, to tell him that. And then he said the reason why he felt sorry for me had got nothing to do with the case. Well, what on earth had it got to do with? If you don't want to talk about it, of course, I understand perfectly," Claude said in a most mysterious way. "Have you been taking lessons for the Sphinx, old thing?" I ventured to ask Claude. "You're speaking in riddles." "It must have come." The chump Claude looked at me extremely seriously, like a dagger through the heart. "If you're speaking of my occasional fits of indiscretion, I find a quick brandy works wonders," I told him. And then he asked how long you and I had been married. "And what did you tell him?" "That I couldn't remember." Typical, Rumpel, entirely typical. "Well, it's getting along for 47 years. Nearly half a century. And I wondered, Dodo, if that made it too late to seek a new world." "And then Claude said the most extraordinary thing," Rumpel said quite seriously. "It might make it a lot easier if you were thinner." "What did he mean?" I asked him that, and he said, "Positions and all that sort of thing. Can you understand what he meant?"
"No."
That was true, at least, Dodo. Quite honestly, I couldn't. "Do you think anything would be easier if I were thinner?" Rumpel was puzzled. "Putting on your socks, perhaps." Perhaps that's what he meant. Rumpel thought it over. "Claude said that a simple diet might make all the difference. Then he gave me a long, sorrowful look and buggered off. I turned my own long, sorrowful look back to the Daily Telegraph crossword, which had managed to defeat me, and silence reigned in Froxbury Mansions until Rumpole said, "Skelton's fixed for the 4th of next month. It'll be quite an occasion. Danny Newcombe's attending the trial in person. He'll be staying in the same hotel. Rather a drawback, really. I don't want to spend every dinner time getting unhelpful advice from my instructing solicitor." "Rumpole," I started, not after I'd thought things over, but after I'd given way to a sudden, irresistible temptation. "Can I come too?"
"Come where?"
"To East Sussex Assizes. To stay in the
old Bear Hotel."
"Yes."
"Why on earth would you want to do that?"
"Because it's a long time since I've seen you in action, Rumpole."
"What do you mean, Hilda?"
"I mean it's a long time since I've seen you in court."
"Well, if you really want to. I'll be working most evenings. I mean, I don't suppose it'll be much fun for you."
"Oh, I think I might like it quite a lot."
And then, after we had sat in silence for another 5 minutes, I said,
"Rumpole?"
"Yes, Hilda."
"You know the poem you're always reciting? 'Tis not too late to seek a newer world. We are not now that strength which in old days moved earth and heaven."
Rumpole's brief was folded in his lap with his hands over it. He sat back in his chair, his eyes shut, and recited, "We are not now that strength which in old days moved earth and heaven. That which we are. One equal temper of heroic hearts, made weak by time and fate, but strong in will to strive, to seek, to find, and not to yield."
"And not to yield," I repeated. "I'm not quite sure about that."
It was true, Dodo. I hadn't seen Rumpole in court for a long time. And I had to admit, reluctantly, that as soon as he took his seat in the second row, the front one is reserved for the queer customers, he was a man in his element. Mr. Justice Graves looked just like Rumpole's description, a man on his deathbed about to make a will cutting out almost everyone he could think of. Claude, opening the case, looked nervous and not always in complete control of his voice, which trilled up into a high note of indignation as he described the peculiar horror of the crime. Liz Probert, sitting behind him, was frowning as though she feared some terrible insult to women was about to be offered in evidence, although I couldn't for the life of me see how the case concerned women at all. Michael Skelton, in the dock, was small, dark, pale and neat, looking absurdly young, like a schoolboy at some important event, such as a prize-giving, and not like a murderer at all. Although I wondered if there was any particular way of recognizing a murderer, and how many of those old clients Danny recognized in the crush bar might have done someone in. Only Rumpole, spreading out his papers, dropping them on the floor, pushing back his wig to scratch his head, or pushing it forwards as he yawned heavily and closed his eyes, seemed likely to dominate the courtroom. He looked, I thought, far more at home than he ever does in Froxbury Mansions, and I was in no doubt he would continue his real life in court, whether I was there or not. I sat with the solicitors next to Danny. The court was so full that we had to sit close together, and from time to time, when he moved to look for a statement or pass a note, his arm brushed mine. I could feel the roughness of his sleeve and smell his discreet eau de cologne. On Danny's other side sat Mr. Turnbull, a squat, red-faced man with a bull neck, who called me madam and already seemed to regard me as attached to his employer rather than to Rumpole. "Well, Dodo, I don't know how much you remember of the Skelton murder trial, and I'm certainly not going to bore you by going through all the evidence that took up one of the strangest and most unnerving weeks of my life. Of course, I remember every moment of it. But it's difficult for me to write about it without cold shivers and flushes of embarrassment. But, as we used to say long ago, If you can live through Gertie's French lessons, you can live through anything. So here goes. First came the Beasleys, who worked for Skelton and lived in a cottage about 50 yards from the back door of Longacre. Mrs. Beasley, a wobbling, panting woman with a look of perpetual discontent, was the cook-housekeeper, and Mr. Beasley, a short, weaselly sort of person, who spoke as though he was always apologizing for something. Perhaps working for the deceased plastic surgeon meant always having to say you're sorry, was the driver and handyman. "I'm afraid Mrs. Beasley has quite a taste for old war films, my lord," Beasley apologized from the witness stand. "And we had the one on again about the Yankees fighting over a Pacific island." "Iwo Jima." Claude was helping him as Rumpole growled. "Don't lead... Iwo Jima. Thank you, sir. Well, the guns were firing and the bombs dropping, and my wife, sir, was thoroughly enjoying herself, and that was it until the film finished. I doubt very much if we'd heard anything from the house before then." "And what time did the film end?" Claude asked. "I think it was about 11 o'clock time." "And what happened after that?" "Well, I heard someone calling from the house. It was a sort of call for help." And then Beasley described how he went across to the house and found a scene of blood-stained confusion and saw Michael Skelton holding a golf club beside the battered body of his father, who appeared to be already dead. "Now then, Beasley..." Rumpole, it seemed, was prepared to sail into the first prosecution witness with his guns blazing. "You heard a cry for help, and you crossed the yard and went into the house. How long did it take you to get into the hallway from the moment you heard the cry?" "I might venture to suggest a matter of seconds, sir." "You might venture to suggest it, Beasley, and you might well be correct. And when you first saw Mr. Skelton Senior, he appeared to you to be dead?" "He appeared to me to be very dead, sir." "So if he was dead, then he's unlikely to have been able to call out for help a few seconds before." "That would seem to follow, Mr. Rumpole." A weary and sepulchral voice came from the bench, apparently inviting Rumpole to get on with it and not waste time. At which my husband, with elaborate courtesy, said, "Thank you, my lord. Thank you for that helpful interruption in favour of the defence. Now, Beasley, you say you and your wife were watching a war film at 10:45. "He has already told us that, Mr. Rumpole." Graves was making it clear that he hadn't joined the defence team. "Any rumpus in the hallway, which took place at that time, would have been drowned by the Battle of Iwo Jima." "Yes, sir." "So you heard no voices from the house at that time?"
"No, sir."
"But when you did hear a voice, we are agreed it could hardly have been that of Mr. Skelton Senior."
"No, sir. It might very well have been the voice of my client, young Michael Skelton."
"It might have been."
"Calling for help for the man he's accused of murdering. Is that your evidence?"
And without waiting for a reply, Rumpole swathed himself in his gown and sat down in triumph. This gesture had the unfortunate effect of tempting Graves, Mr. Injustice Gravestone, I've heard Rumpole call him, to restore the balance by asking the witness if it were also possible that the young man was calling for help because he didn't realize how seriously he had injured his father, a proposition with which the obedient Beasley was delighted to agree.
"The judge is against us."
Danny turned to whisper to Rumpole.
"So much the better."
Rumpole was indestructibly cheerful. "We'll make the jury realize how highly prejudiced the old death head is. That might get us a sympathy verdict." But all looks of sympathy seemed to me to drain out of the jury's faces when Mrs. Beasley struggled into the witness box and described what had happened when she served dinner on that fatal evening. "From the first course, a nice roast beef done with my own horseradish sauce," she panted, "she'd heard father and son arguing,
and the son getting more and more agitated as Mr. Skelton stayed calm and determined. Michael would have to finish his medical course, or he wouldn't get another penny, his father told him. And if he thought he could live on poetry, he was welcome to try it, eked out with a bit of national assistance. But he wasn't going to live for nothing in his father's house. I thought it was strange of Mr. Skelton to tell his son all that with a heavily breathing cook in the room, but perhaps he was one of those people who think their workers are deaf and blind, and probably have no real existence at all. The evidence was, at its worst, when Mrs. Beasley came back with the treacle tart and cream. Mr. Skelton always had a sweet tooth, bless him, and I make treacle tart according to my own recipe, which he said couldn't be beaten. Michael was standing up and shouting at his father. I've got a whole long life to lead, and you might die quite soon. There was a sudden awful silence, and then Mrs. Beasley went on. They just looked at each other, and neither of them said anything. I set the plates for their dessert and just got out as quickly as I could. When she came back to clear away at about 9 o'clock, the dining room was empty, and she thought they had probably gone into the drawing room. Mr. Skelton always liked the coffee served with the pudding. Then she settled down to watch her favourite war film and knew no more until her husband told her that he telephoned for the police and an ambulance was on its way. Rumpole always told me that if a witness was telling the truth, you should keep the cross-examination short. I don't know why he told me that, Dodo. He could hardly have thought that I'd have ever been in a position to cross-examine anybody. So he was clearly anxious to get Mrs. Beasley out of the witness box as quickly as possible. He established the fact that Michael might have left the house after dinner and not returned until after 11, and then he let her go. Danny turned his head and whispered in my ear, "He hasn't even challenged her evidence about Michael saying his father might die quite soon. The strongest evidence against us, and Rumpole hasn't even contradicted it." It seemed to me he spoke more in sorrow than in anger. I'll spare you the gory details, Dodo. Rumpole particularly enjoyed himself with the forensic evidence. He seems to regard himself as the greatest living authority on bloodstains. There was blood of his father's group on Michael's hands, his shirt cuffs, on one of his sleeves and on the head of the golf club. Rumpole seemed to be suggesting that the blood got on Michael's clothes when he knelt down to examine his father's wounds, and I thought that he had made a bit of a headway with this theory in spite of the gloomy interventions of the learned judge. "I thought your client didn't want to be a doctor, Mr. Rumpole," was one of them. "I don't know why he would have been so anxious to examine the wounds." Rumpole also got the scene of the crime officer to agree that the grandfather clock in the hall had fallen over and stopped at 10:45, which probably would have been the time of the attack. He also established that it was a Saturday, and that Skelton had been playing golf, and had left his bag of clubs in the hall so his assailant wouldn't have had far to look for a weapon. At 4 o'clock, Claude got to his feet and asked to raise a matter. He told the judge that the defence had filed an alibi notice, stating that Michael Skelton was in the woods reading a poem he had written to some New Age travellers. However, Mr. Rumpole had failed to give the prosecution the names of the witnesses they intended to call to support this so-called alibi. "Well, Mr. Rumpole?" Graves asked, in a voice as near to doom as he could make it. "Why has the defence not supplied the names of their alibi witnesses?" "Simply because we haven't traced them yet, my lord." Rumpole can, when hard pressed to it, manage a disarming smile. "And what steps have you taken?" "We have advertised, my lord, in several publications." "Aren't these travellers committing an offence under the new Criminal Justice Act? I imagine they were camping without permission in Mr. Skelton's woodland." "Even those who commit offences read newspapers, my lord. We shall produce the advertisements we placed in Time Out." "Time what, Mr. Rumpole?" His lordship was making a note. "Out, my lord. The Big Issue and the East Sussex Gazette." Have you got them there?
Rumpo leant forward to whisper to Danny, who, in close consultation with Turnbull, was going through the file.
I'm afraid we didn't.
You didn't what?
I'm sorry, Mr. Rumpo.
The red-faced clerk was looking extremely flustered.
Pressure of work. I'm afraid advertising got overlooked.
Overlooked? This is a charge of murder, you know, not an unrenewed dog license. I saw Claude and Liz Probert smiling, enjoying Rumpole's discomfiture. And Danny, as shocked as he was, told Rumpole, I'm afraid there's no excuse for Turnbull. Of course, I can't deal with every detail personally. I've told him that. Well, Rumpole managed to wipe the anger off his face and stood up and smiled again. He asked Graves to adjourn the case so that the advertisements might be published. After lengthy argument, his lordship refused to grant an adjournment. The case could take several more days and would be fully reported in the press. When he left court, Rumpole said, Thank God he's given us a ground of appeal. But I could tell that he was still very angry indeed. Rumpole was late getting back to the hotel that night, so Danny and I decided to go in to dinner without him. It was hardly cheerful in the dining room, distinctly cold, hung with sporting prints and heavy with the smell of furniture polish and overcooked lamb. Whilst we were waiting for the soup, Danny said, I'm seriously worried about your husband, Hilda.
Why?
At that moment, I wasn't worrying about Rumpole particularly. He started off badly, getting on the wrong side of the judge. And I'm not at all sure the jury liked the way he's handling our case. Do you honestly think he wants to win? I honestly think Rumpole wants to win every case he does. The only thing is...
What, Hilda?
I think he was cross because the advertisements hadn't gone in the papers. I tore Turnbull off a most terrific strip about that. Not that I believe it was a particularly hopeful line of country. Can you imagine any of these travellers turning up? Let's face it, Hilda. Those sort of free spirits spend their time keeping away from the law. The soup came then, beige in colour and not particularly hot. In spite of these drawbacks, I was enjoying my stay at the Old Bear, particularly when Danny gave me one of his most twinkling looks and said in a confidential sort of way, Hilda.
Yes?
Will you do something for me? I don't know why it was, Dodo, that I felt suddenly breathless when he asked me that, but I tried to answer him as calmly as possible. It depends on what it is, but I'll try.
Keep an eye on Rumpole, will you? I know he's not pleased with me, and he may not tell me what he's got in mind. So if he's planning to take any sort of peculiar line...
What sort of peculiar line?
I don't know. But if he gets any really strange ideas, you will let me know, won't you?
I suppose so, I found myself saying.
Well, all right.
Thank you, Hilda, dear. I knew I could trust you. And then he put his hand on mine. I can see it now in my mind's eye, Dodo. My hand was on the table, and his, slightly suntanned, with the carefully tended nails and heavy gold signet ring on the little finger, was on top of it. And then I looked up, and there was Rumpole standing in the doorway. I think he must have seen where Danny's hand was, but he never mentioned it. And as for me, well, you may be sure, Dodo, I never asked him whether he had seen it or not. I hope you don't mind. We've started without you. Danny gave my husband his most dazzling smile. Apparently. Rumpole was far from friendly.
You haven't been working.
I wanted to sound sympathetic.
Someone has to. I've been down the cells with Michael.
I don't suppose you learnt anything new.
As a matter of fact, I did.
Something he hadn't the sense to tell us before. He said he didn't, out of respect for his father's memory. He's a strange lad. It's almost as though he wants to get himself convicted. Anyway, he gave me the name of the doctor.
Which doctor, Rumpole? Fellow called Christy Vickers. Mine's a shop somewhere in Harley Street. Michael isn't sure where. About 2 weeks before the quarrel.
You mean the quarrel when Skelton got killed? Danny interrupted.
No, I mean the quarrel Mrs. Beasley heard at dinner. His father told him that Christy Vickers had diagnosed cancer of the prostate. That's why he said the skin doctor might die soon, and he couldn't expect Michael to live on doing a job he hated.
He's only just thought of that.
Danny looked doubtful.
He's only just decided to tell us. Perhaps he's beginning to realize that even poets can't ignore the evidence against them.
It wasn't a particularly nice thing for the boy to say to his father.
I was feeling as skeptical as Danny did about young Skelton.
He's not accused of not being particularly nice, Hilda.
Rumpo was quite sharp with me, Dodo. He is on trial for murder.
So you want me to get onto this Christy Vickers?
Danny got out a little pad and a leather case and made a note with a gold pencil.
Now would hardly be soon enough.
So Danny went off to telephone, and when the waitress came to take his order, Rumpole astonished me.
Just a green salad, if you can manage it, he said.
And perhaps a hunk of cheese.
A smallish hunk, I suppose.
Rumpole? I looked at him. Are you sickening for something?
I don't think so, he said. Are you?
We didn't say much more until Danny came back and said he'd found Dr. Christy Vickers in the telephone book and tried his house number but got no reply. He'd ring the Harley Street consulting room in the morning. That night I honestly thought I must tell Rumpole.
Tell him what, you may say, after reading this far, which, as a story of illicit love and infidelity, would be considered too uneventful for your average parish magazine, and would certainly not get a line in the Daily Telegraph. But Danny had invited me, hadn't he, not only to the opera, but to share his life. What else was all that stuff about it not being too late to seek a newer world and pushing off and smiting the sounding furrows? I was sitting up in my twin bed in the Old Bear, as these thoughts flickered through my mind, looking at the yellowing walls and repeated patterns of daisies on the curtains and bed covers, the electric kettle and assorted tea bags on a rather unsteady shelf, and hearing the sound, like a wail rising up through the waves and spouting, which was Rumpole cleaning his teeth in the ensuite bathroom. When he came back with his hair standing on end, in his old camel hair dressing gown and striped pyjamas, he looked, I thought, like a small boy to whom something unexpectedly outrageous has suddenly happened. I really don't know why it was. Perhaps I wanted to put off telling him for as long as possible. Or did I want to justify myself by putting Rumpole in the wrong? Quite honestly, Dodo, I can't be sure why I did it, but I said, "Danny's worried about the way you're doing the case." Danny? Why do you call him Danny?
You said everyone did.
Perhaps everyone hasn't got a special reason. Have you, Hilda?
I told you he's worried about the case.
I expect he has other worries on his mind also. What was that wretched opera you saw? Don Giovanni? That bed-hopping Spaniard had a few worries on his plate, from what I remember. And didn't he come to a sticky end?
Rumpole, I didn't like the turn the conversation was taking. You're going to lose Skelton, aren't you?
Why? Am I in the habit of losing cases?
It has been known. Danny,
let's call him Mr. Newcombe, shall we? Now that you've really got to know him.
All right. Mr. Newcombe says it's obvious Michael did it for the money. Even if you lose and he goes away for 10 years, he'll come out and collect 3 million.
Did Newcombe tell you that?
He didn't say he wouldn't.
At this point, Rumpole sat down on the edge of my bed and began to talk in a slow and patient sort of way, as though to a child. "A murderer can't profit as a result of his crime, Hilda. If Michael's convicted of murder, he won't be able to benefit from his father's estate. Newcombe knows that as well as I do."
"Did Michael know?"
"He said he did when I pointed it out to him."
"Then he must be an extremely stupid young man."
"Not at all. He got a scholarship to King's, and he writes poetry of a sort."
"So he does the murder in a way which is almost certain to be discovered, hangs about by the corpse and calls for help so that a witness can see him with a blood-stained golf club in his hand, all so that he won't get the money from his father's will. Does that really sound likely?"
Rumpole, who had been looking at me with a mixture of resentment and grief, now spoke with unusual respect.
"Hilda," he said, "I don't know how you managed it, but you seem to have hit on a better argument than a little queasiness at the sight of blood."
"Thank you." I was able to look dignified and aloof.
"You're perfectly at liberty to use it, Rumpole."
He couldn't quite decide how to reply to that, and instead of raising the difficult subject of Danny Newcombe again, he took off his dressing gown, hung it up, as usual, on the floor, and climbed into his twin bed.
"Perhaps we should go to sleep now. You've got the police interviews tomorrow, remember?"
I switched off my light, and he switched off his.
"Hilda?"
His voice came out of the darkness.
"Have you got anything else to tell me?"
"No, Rumpole. Not now, anyway. Let's go to sleep." But I didn't. I lay awake for a long time. And I was surprised to find that I was no longer thinking about pushing off and smiting the sounding furrows. I was remembering the pale, calm face of Michael Skelton, and asking myself questions which became more unnerving as I stared into the darkness, where familiar objects, such as Rumpole's fallen dressing gown and the electric kettle, seemed to take on new and surprising shapes. The next morning, I have to confess, Dodo, was boring. I was sitting in court, turning over the photographs bound together in a slim volume and marked Prosecution 1. You see how used I am getting to courtroom expressions. Before the judge sat, Mr. Turnbull told us that he'd rung Christy Vickers' secretary, and the doctor was driving through France with his wife, but they do their best to find him. Rumpole had received the news fairly calmly for him, and when the police were reading accounts of their interviews with Michael from their notebooks, he closed his eyes and acted the part of someone enjoying a light doze, in order to show the jury how unimportant the evidence was. Turnbull had gone off on some errand, and I was alone in the front row with Danny, who was also finding it hard to keep his eyes open. I'm not as squeamish as young Michael, Dodo. You know how he used to open up a frog in biology lessons. And I had no qualms about cutting up a rabbit when we used to eat them after the war. But I must confess, I flicked over the photos taken on the mortuary slab and the colour close-ups of the head wounds. I enjoyed the exterior views of Longacre and thought that such a spread would be a step up from Froxbury Mansions. And then I got to the most recent photograph of the beauty doctor when he was alive, the picture the police used for the purposes of identification. He was as handsome as his son, with the same high-arched nose, full lips and large dark eyes and black hair. Only the surgeon's good looks were more arrogant, more supercilious, and his hair was just starting to turn grey over the ears. I thought it odd that the victim looked more dangerous and even brutal than his killer. I yawned a little, bit my tongue to keep myself awake, and then looked up to the ceiling of the old courtroom. The public gallery was quite full, but there, standing in a doorway at the back of it, I saw Skelton, the murdered man. I swear to you, Dodo, I saw him clearly. There were no head wounds, of course. In fact, he looked remarkably well, and suntanned, as though since his death he'd found time for a Caribbean holiday. Indeed, he looked as though he were still on holiday. His white shirt was open at the neck. He wore a blazer and, I think, fawn-coloured trousers. He seemed to be reasonably interested in the proceedings caused by his death, although I couldn't help noticing, as the police evidence droned on, that he covered his mouth with the back of his hand, politely concealing a small yawn. I must have given a small gasp, an intake of breath, hardly a cry, and certainly not loud enough to stir Rumpole from his simulated sleep. But Danny looked towards where I was staring, and it seemed to me that he aged quite suddenly. I had, at my most besotted moments, given him late 50s, and now he was middle 70s, without a doubt, in front of my eyes. He got to his feet, and in trying to go quietly stumbled a little, bowed to the judge, and left the court. I made sure that Michael, sitting in the dock, his hands folded in his lap and his head down, couldn't see who was in the gallery immediately above his head, and so he missed the sight of his father, returned from the grave and looking extremely well. I also saw that Rumpole wasn't looking. Then I turned my eyes to heaven again, and there, by the gallery doorway, Danny Newcombe was whispering urgently to the ghost. For if it wasn't Dimitri Skelton's spirit, I had no idea, I promise you, Dodo, what it was. But I was going to find out. I got up, did my best possible bow to the judge, who, as usual, also looked dead, and left the court. As I left, Rumpole opened one speculative eye. I came out of the courtroom door into the entrance hall, and I heard voices from the stairs which led down from the public gallery. You know what I took into my head to do, Dodo? I hid. You might think I'm not exactly the shape for it now, not sylph-like as I was when we squeezed in behind the dormitory door to jump out and scare that ghastly little show-off Dorothy Bliss witless. But the hall was pretty dark, and there were some thick stone pillars, and I tucked behind them somehow. I was just in time to see Danny and the deceased cross to the main entrance. Danny was talking quietly, but his voice echoed across the stone floor. I suppose he might have been speaking to a ghost. "I told you to keep away," he was saying. "I told you to go back down under and never come near me again." Then he pulled open one of the big glass doors, and they both stepped out into the sunlight. I tried to walk quietly across the hallway then. My footsteps seemed to clatter and echo, but there was no one there to notice me. I stood by the doors and looked through to the sunlit car park. I saw the figure that seemed to be Dimitri Skelton get into a car, and Danny slammed the door. The car was parked very near the law court steps, and I could see a sticker for Rudyard's Cars, Lewis, on the back window. I was even able to notice part of the number, ARB, and I think it ended with an S. You see, at that moment I had stopped being a discontented housewife with longings for a newer world. At that moment, Dodo, I had become a lawyer, or at least a detective. Oh, when the man with the suntan and the open-necked shirt drove the car away, I made quite sure, Dodo, that he wasn't dead. I've had very little experience of the afterlife, but I don't think dead people go driving around East Sussex in a hired car. I didn't go back to court that afternoon. I had too much to think about. What was that poem of Michael's? Something about the dead around us all reply. Well, the dead, or someone very like the dead, had brought a message to me which I knew was important, although I didn't fully understand it yet. There was a lot still to find out, so I took a taxi to Longacre, about 5 miles out of the town, and asked the driver to wait for me. It had obviously been a lovely old farmhouse, Dodo, but there was something rather flashy and obviously false about it, like a woman who has had too obvious a facelift and wears a lot of costume jewellery. Carriage lamps gleamed brassily on each side of the front door. There were white plastic lounging chairs around the pool bar, a lot of chalky white statues from a garden centre, cherubs and frogs and things like that, and an ostentatious burglar alarm. I walked round to the back of the house and knocked at the Beasleys' door. There was some noisy shuffling and gasping from inside, and then Mrs. Beasley opened it. I introduced myself, said I was just passing, and there was something I wanted to ask her. When I told her that my husband, one of the lawyers in the case, doted on treacle tart, and I was never quite sure of the recipe, she invited me in. She was alone and seemed in need of company. "Spoonful of black treacle," she told me, "to go with the golden syrup. 3 teaspoonfuls of white breadcrumbs and the grated rind of a lemon. I'll write it out for you if you'd like." At which she sat down heavily at the kitchen table. "Would you?" I said. "That would be extremely kind." While she made off in the direction of a pencil and paper, I carried on. "Life must seem strange to you without Mr. Skelton." "I don't know what's going to happen to us," Mrs. Beasley gasped. "I don't know what he's done for us in the will. Mr. Newcomb's not told us about that." "Mr. Newcomb? The gentleman, what's the family solicitor?" She waddled back to the table and sat down with a pencil and paper, which she forgot about as we moved away from the subject of treacle tart. "Yes, of course. I knew what Dimitri Skelton had done about the Beasleys in his will. Nothing. He didn't seem to have been a man who cared much for the people who worked with him, but I didn't say that. I said, Mr. Skelton must have been very handsome. Such an attractive man, wasn't he?" "To some people, I suppose." She spoke as though she had a considerable contempt for handsome men, this scarcely mobile woman with a passion for war films. "To that secretary of his, I suppose he was attractive. That's why we were going to have to leave anyway, even if none of this had ever happened." She spoke of this, a terrible murder, Dodo, as though it had been an inconveniently leaking radiator. "Raymond and I couldn't have stayed after she took over." "You didn't like Miss Ashton, Miss Elizabeth Ashton. Came into my kitchen and said she'd show me how to cook. Trendy food, she said, like they got in some place up in London. Pasta, that meant spaghetti, but she would call it pasta. Well, you don't need much brain to boil spaghetti, and I could do that. But she wanted it with scallops and squids in it, and stuff like that. If he wants fish, I told her, what about a nice fish pie? One night, she decided to cook for herself and made a terrible mess of my kitchen. Clean out the saucepans, she wouldn't have considered it. Wasn't she Australian? That's no excuse, though, is it? Yes, I think he said she'd come from Australia. Mr. Skelton had some relation over there, cousin or something, and he'd said she might be suitable for the job. Far too suitable, Raymond, and I thought he found her. We couldn't have stayed. Not if she were permanent. I have to say, Dodo, I felt quite triumphant when she told me that. You see, I was out on my own, and far, far ahead of Rumpole. I thought perhaps that Mrs. Beasley had still more to tell me, so I said, "I did admire the way you gave your evidence. It must have been terrifying standing up there in front of all those people in wigs." "Oh, I didn't mind once I got started. And your husband was very nice to me. Nice as pie, he was. Though they warned me he could be a bit of a terrier with a witness. The trouble was..." She hesitated. "Yes, Mrs. Beasley. What was the trouble?" "Well, you can't tell them everything, can you? You're only meant to answer their questions." "Is there anything you didn't tell them?" She panted a little and then said, "Yes. About Raymond."
"What about Raymond?"
"Well, he missed a bit of the film. A really good bit he missed, when there was hard fighting. He had to go to the toilet, if I have to be honest. And he looked out of the window, upstairs. And in the yard between us and the big house, there was a car parked."
"A strange car?"
"Well, Ray'd never seen it before. He happened to notice the number. I know the first 3 letters, if you like, because they happen to be his initials."
"What are your husband's names?" Raymond Beasley? Albert Raymond Beasley. We went to Mr. Newcombe, you know, and asked if we should say anything about it. But he said it wasn't that important. I think it may have been. Don't you?
Yes, Mrs. Beasley. I think it may have been very important indeed. Now, do you think there's any chance of a cup of coffee while we write out that recipe? It was a bit of cheek saying that, I knew, in someone else's kitchen, but I felt I'd earned it. When I got back to the hotel, I had some telephone calls to make, one to Rudyard's Cars and another to the house of Dr. Christie Vickers, who, I was not altogether surprised to find, had got back from his holiday trip in France. Then I have to confess, Dodo, that such was my mood that I went straight into the bar and ordered myself a small sherry. And there was the bull-necked Turnbull in conversation with a strange-looking creature. I believe she was a woman, but her hair was clipped and bristly, a sort of stubble all over her head. At first sight, her face seemed beautiful and even young. But when you looked more closely, she had lines which, like you or I, Dodo, she made no attempt to conceal. She wore patched jeans and a sort of camouflage jacket over a T-shirt and enormous earrings. She was smoking what seemed to be a homemade cigarette and talking very quietly, so I couldn't overhear what she was saying. After a while, she got up and left. Turnbull finished what looked like a dark and generous whisky and said, "Good evening, Mrs. Rumpole," on his way out. "Was that a New Age traveller?" I asked him, as though my curiosity was perfectly idle. "How did you know?" "I thought that was what they looked like." "She'd read about the case in the local paper." "And you're going to call her?" "Hardly. You know what she said?" "I've no idea." "That she knew we needed one of the travellers to give evidence, and she'd say anything for £100 in the hand. Terrible world, isn't it, Mrs. Rumpole? They live like pigs and then pervert the course of justice. Good evening to you." "Good evening, Mr. Turnbull." I tried my best to look as though I believed what he'd told me. Then I'm very much afraid I ordered another sherry. I had hardly finished it when Rumpole came into the Downlands bar, looking tired and not particularly happy. I told him to order a large red wine, a bottle of it, if that would cheer him up, and invited him to sit beside me. "Hilda, are you feeling well?" He looked, I have to admit, apprehensive. "Have you something to tell me?" "A good many things, but first let me ask you something. What do you call down under?" "Down under?" The poor man looked entirely confused, and when the first glass of wine was put in front of him, he took a quick and consoling gulp. "What do you mean?" "I don't mean hell, Rumpole. I don't mean where Don Giovanni ended up. Where else do you call down under?" "Do you mean Australia?" "Yes, Rumpole, I mean Australia." And, of course, that was what Danny meant. "Hilda, I asked if you were feeling well. Has this trial been too much for you?" "Not at all. I was afraid it was too much for you, so I found you a defence." "I thought you went out shopping." He gave a distinctly mirthless laugh. "Where did you get my new defence from, Marks and Sparks? You were out shopping a long time. I was surprised that Mr. Daniel Newcombe had the courtesy to stay with me. When he went out of court this morning, I saw you troop after him soon enough." "Rumpole?" I hope I smiled tolerantly, as that would have been the most effective way. "You're never jealous, are you?" "Jealous? Should I be?" "No, I really don't think you should. Mr. Newcombe and I left the court because we both saw Dimitri Skelton in the public gallery." "Hilda, you're joking." "Or delirious," was what he wanted to say.
It wasn't exactly funny.
You mean you saw the man they all say was murdered?
I've tried that defense before. Rumpole was back to his usual patronizing self. Witnesses saying they saw the corpse alive after the date of the murder. It has a sort of biblical authority, I suppose, but it never worked particularly well down the Old Bailey. Is that your defense, Hilda?
No, as a matter of fact, it isn't. We didn't see Dimitri Skelton.
Hilda, please. I'm tired and unusually depressed.
If you're tired, sit back in your chair and listen, Rumpole. I'll tell you who we did see, and then you'd better scoot down to the cells early tomorrow morning and ask your Michael Skelton some pertinent questions.
Such as?
Such as how much he knows about Miss Elizabeth Ashton from Down Under.
He looked at me then, and entirely for his own good, decided to listen quietly.
We talked for a while, time enough for Rumpole to get through a bottle of wine. And do you know, Dodo, it was the most serious, even enjoyable, conversation we'd had for a long time. It didn't take him long to get the hang of what I was saying, and when he did, he knew exactly what to do. When I had told him everything, he said,
I suppose you realize what this means.
What it means for Michael Skelton?
No, for your friend Danny Boy.
Yes, I said. I do realize.
And you don't mind?
No, I told him. I don't think I mind at all.
Rumpole left very early in the morning to go to the cells and have a further conversation with the non-talkative Michael Skelton.
Dodo, I felt strangely calm. I realized that for the last few months, ever since that dinner in the Sheridan with Danny Newcombe, in fact, I'd been nervous, strung up, and even, if I have to say it myself, rather silly. Now I had killed what had been going on in my mind for a long time. Rumpole always says that the real murderers he had met, I mean the ones who had actually done it, were always strangely calm, as though something had been decided forever. Anyway, after Rumpole had gone, I had a nice bath, making full use of the complimentary sachet of country garden toiletries in the little wickerwork basket on the glass shelf. I have to confess that I pinched the verbena shampoo and hollyhock skin freshener, together with a little packet of sewing stuff. I do find that staying in hotels brings out everyone's criminal tendencies. Then I put on the rather nice coat and skirt I had been wearing in court, and went down to the Sussex-by-the-Sea coffee shop for the full English breakfast. And there was Danny Newcombe, standing at a table by the door, throwing down his Financial Times and offering me a seat at his table. I accepted and sat down.
So we're going to have the pleasure of your company in court again today, Hilda.
If you think it's a pleasure, yes.
You must have thought it rather strange when I suddenly bolted out yesterday.
I didn't think it strange at all, I lied.
I thought I saw someone I knew in the public gallery. Did you see me go up there?
No,
I went on lying. It was all a mistake. I mean, it wasn't anyone I knew.
Well, that's all right then.
Yes. And then he said very seriously now, I'm afraid there's not much hope for us. I looked at him and said,
You mean you're afraid there's not much hope for Michael Skelton?
That's what I mean, yes.
I don't think you should be so sure of that. You never know what Rumpole's going to pull out of the bag.
You mean you do know, Hilda?
He gave me his best twinkling smile, complete with the wrinkles at the corners of his eyes.
And you promised to tell me if he had one of his funny ideas, didn't you?
I thought for one dreadful moment that he was going to add, You naughty girl, Hilda.
If I promised that, I told him, I'm afraid I'm not going to keep my promise.
Why ever not?
Because I don't think Rumpole would like it.
Oh, and I'll tell you something else I'm not going to do.
What's that?
I'm not going to smite the sounding furrows. I have to tell you this, Mr. Newcombe. It's far too late to seek a newer world. He looked at me then as though he didn't quite understand what I was talking about. I noticed he had dropped a lump of scrambled egg on what he told me was the Sheridan Club tie. I have to tell you, Dodo, that I thought it looked quite disgusting. Members of the jury, young Michael Skelton may seem guilty, kneeling beside the body, his father's blood on his hands, clutching that fatal golf club. But things, members of the jury, are not always as they seem. Let us together, you and I, set out to discover the truth behind that strange and terrible apparition. Ladies and gentlemen, look back to the time when you were but 20 years old, and consider how you would have felt if you'd had to go into the witness box and defend yourself on such a serious charge as this. It would be an ordeal for anyone. And here Rumpel's voice sank to a tone of deep insincerity, and he leaned forward and stared at the jury. It must be terrible for the innocent. Then he straightened up and trumpeted out the summons. Call Michael Skelton. Michael's performance wasn't, of course, anything like as good as Rumpel's. He remained strangely aloof, but he looked pale, proud, and vulnerable. He retold his story quite clearly, and when Claude came to cross-examine him, he seemed suddenly bored, as though he thought it quite unnecessary to go through the whole thing again, and was privately composing a poem. Claude didn't really get anywhere, but when Michael left the witness box, the jury probably still thought that he'd killed his father. And then Rumpel surprised everyone, and particularly Danny, by saying, "My next witness will be my instructing solicitor, Mr. Daniel Newcombe." Sitting next to me, but as far away as possible now, as though we were a married couple in bed after a quarrel, Danny gave a little gasp of surprise and turned round to Rumpel. "You don't mean you're calling me?" "That's the general idea. Will you just step into the witness box?" Danny had no choice then, but I thought he walked as grimly as a soldier crossing a minefield. When he reached the exposed little platform, he raised the Bible with a great air of confidence, and, encouraged by a rare smile from the gravestone, promised to tell the whole truth and nothing but the truth. "Mr. Newcombe," Rumpel was quietly courteous, "you are familiar with the late Dimitri Skelton's will?" "I should be. I drafted it." "He drafted it, Mr. Rumpel?" His lordship did his best to raise a small laugh against Rumpel. Claude even obliged. "I am aware of that, my lord." Rumpel gave a small bow and then turned to Danny. "Now, in the event of this jury finding Michael guilty, he won't be able to inherit under his father's will he? "We all know that, Mr. Rumpel, don't we? A murderer can't profit from his crime." The judge did his best to patronise Rumpel, who replied with elaborate courtesy, "Exactly, my lord. I do so congratulate your lordship. You have put your finger upon the nub, the very heart of this case. Now, who is to benefit if my client is found guilty of murder?" "Well, Elizabeth Ashton will still get her £100,000 legacy." Danny looked as though he now felt that the witness box wouldn't be so dangerous after all. "Miss Elizabeth Ashton, remind us, she is Dimitri Skelton's secretary, is she not?" "That is so, my lord." Danny chose to give his answer to the judge. "And the residue of the estate?" "That would all go to the deceased's cousin in Australia, Ivan Skelton." "About £3 million, isn't it?" "Something like that, yes." "Lucky old Ivan." The jury giggled slightly, and the judge looked deeply pained. "Of course, if Michael Skelton is acquitted," Danny added in all fairness, "Ivan doesn't get a penny."
So Ivan must be praying for a guilty verdict, mustn't he? This jury comes back and says, guilty, my lord, and bingo, the old darling's worth 3 million.
Mr. Rumpole, Graves was deeply distressed, is this a subject for joking?
Certainly not, my lord. It is extremely serious. Mr. Newcombe, Ivan Skelton is taking a considerable interest in the outcome of this case, isn't he?
I imagine he is concerned about it, yes, Danny had to admit.
You've met Ivan Skelton, haven't you?
Please don't lead.
It was Claude's turn to grumble.
Very well. Mr. Newcombe, have you ever met Ivan Skelton?
I met him when he came to England, yes.
What does he look like?
Well, it's a little difficult to describe.
It is?
Is it?
Doesn't he look exactly like this?
At which Rumpole held up the murdered Dimitri's photograph for all to see, and Claude stood up to whinge.
My lord, Mr. Rumpole is cross-examining this witness.
No, I'm not. I'm refreshing his memory. This is a picture of the dead man, isn't it? Does his cousin look almost exactly like him?
They are about the same age, yes, there is a family resemblance.
Thank you. Rumpole began to rummage among his papers, and Danny looked only moderately worried.
Is that all, Mr. Rumpole?
Graves sighed.
Not quite, my lord.
I'm just wondering, Mr. Rumpole, how far this line is taking you in your defence.
It's taking me to the truth, my lord. Never mind about the defence. Now, Mr. Newcombe.
He turned to the witness box, looking far more pugnacious.
You're the trusted old family solicitor.
I'm the family solicitor, and I suppose I'm old.
Indeed you are.
This secretary, Miss Elizabeth Ashton, she comes from Australia, doesn't she?
I rather think so.
And is she engaged to be married to Ivan Skelton?
So he recommended her to his cousin for the job. He's planning to come over later this year and marry her, is he not?
I have heard that.
Engaged to be married, and she spent weekends with his cousin Dimitri and became his mistress.
Mr. Rumpole. Mr. Justice Graves intruded like the dead general who came to dinner with the Don.
I wonder what this has to do with the charge against your client.
Then wander on, my lord, till truth makes all things plain.
I suppose Rumpole was quoting poetry of some sort as he went on quickly. When did you last see Ivan Skelton, Mr. Newcombe?
I forget. Oh, come now. Your memory's not quite as short as that. There are others in court.
He looked down at me, and I suddenly became others. Who can tell us, if you don't want to? When did you last see him?
Danny looked at me. I thought sadly, as though I had betrayed him.
Yesterday.
Where?
In court.
In this court?
The judge raised his eyebrows.
Yes, my lord, in the public gallery.
No doubt anxious to see if he was going to get his money. And you spoke to him?
Danny looked at me again, pleadingly. I stared back, and he had to answer yes.
What did you say?
Mr. Rumpole, that's pure hearsay.
Graves was doing Claude's job for him.
Of course it is, my lord. One can always trust your lordship, with his great experience, to be right on a point of law. Mr. Newcombe, I advised your firm to advertise for the New Age travellers, and you have not done so?
That is right. I'm afraid it got overlooked.
You declared that the deceased's doctor couldn't be found, and he has been found now without your help.
I'm very glad to hear it.
Are you, Mr. Newcombe? I shall be calling Mr. Beasley to say that a strange car was parked in the yard at Longacre on the night of the murder. Did you tell him that evidence was irrelevant?
My lord,
Claude was stung with activity at last. Mr. Rumpole is cross-examining his own witness.
Not at all.
At the moment, I'm making no attack on Mr. Newcomb. He may genuinely have thought that the presence of a car hired by the murdered man's cousin was quite irrelevant. And I shall be calling Mr. Beasley.
I may have said something.
Danny was about to agree, but Graves did his best to save him. Mr. Rumpole, he said, I agree that this question is an attack on your own witness. It is quite improper. Then let me ask you a quite proper question. Have you, Mr. Daniel Newcombe, been offered a share of Ivan Skelton's winnings to make sure that this young man who stands before us in the dock is convicted of murder?
Mr. Rumpole.
The pale judge seemed, in his indignation, to be rising in his seat again, I thought, like some spectre arising from the tomb. He glared at Rumpole with such terrible disapproval that if you or I, Dodo, had been in his place, I honestly think we'd have simply collapsed, as we felt like doing when Storky Sullivan gave us one of her looks and said she'd have to let our unfortunate parents know we were a disgrace to the school. Rumpole just stood there, smiling in an unusually polite way, and I have to say, I rather admired him as Graves went on, "This cross-examination is going from bad to worse." "Oh, I agree with every word that has fallen from your lordship." Rumpole was still smiling. "We are dealing here with something very bad indeed." "Mr. Rumpole." The old gravestone unclenched his teeth in a vain attempt to call my husband to order. "Do I understand that you are accusing your own solicitor of entering into a criminal conspiracy to get this young man falsely convicted for murder?" "Ah, your lordship puts the matter far more eloquently than I ever could. It is that gift for words that brought your lordship such success at the bar." In fact, Graves hadn't been much of a success at the bar. I remember Rumpole telling me that he'd got his bottom on the bench thanks to his skill in winning a safe conservative seat. I had to admire his lordship's self-control. The temptation to shout at Rumpole at that point is one which personally I would have found irresistible. "At least Mr. Newcombe is entitled to refuse a question likely to incriminate him, is he not?"
"Of course."
Rumpole got more polite as Graves became more irate. "As always, your lordship is perfectly right." "Then I fully intend to warn him. Your lordship can take no other course." So the judge warned the witness that he needn't answer this incriminating question. Danny suddenly looked very old. I wondered why I had even put him in his 60s, and much smaller. He was hardly audible when he said, "My lord, I prefer not to answer." "You prefer not to? That is probably extremely wise." And Rumpole sat down in triumph, looking meaningfully at the jury. Danny Newcombe never returned to sit between me and Mr. Turnbull, but as soon as he left the witness box, scuttled out of court, and to be honest with you, Dodo, I never saw him again. But when I looked up to the public gallery, I saw not Danny talking to Ivan Skelton this time, but a woman with a stubbly head, who looked quite young from a distance, and who had come to tell the truth in spite of Mr. Turnbull. The rest, of course, is history, and I'm sure you read about it in the papers. I don't know whether they gave you Rumpole's final speech, or the bit which began so quietly that the jury had to strain their ears to hear it. "A young man is walking in the woods, making up poetry and reciting it to some modern-day gypsies, when one of Rudyard's cars drives up to Longacre. Out of it gets the man who had hired it, Mr. Ivan Skelton from Sydney, Australia. Why has he come there? Because he has heard of the love affair between Dimitri Skelton and Elizabeth Ashton, whom Ivan was to marry, the girl who came over to work for his cousin and wait for him to join her. Nobody heard the quarrel, members of the jury. The Beasleys were too busy listening to ancient warfare, and the house was empty. overcome with rage and jealousy, did Ivan lift this fatal weapon. By now Rumpel had the golf club high above his head. And strike, and strike, and strike again in the terrible and fatal fight that followed. No one saw Ivan after that fight or gave evidence as to the bloodstains on him. But when young Michael came home and found his father dead, and was stained by his father's blood as he knelt beside the body, was it not natural that he should be suspected? And how very convenient for Ivan that he was. Because if Michael was convicted, Ivan would inherit a fortune. And remember, he was here with us the other day, members of the jury, the man you might think is possibly, quite possibly, even probably, guilty. That man was in the public gallery, making sure his inheritance was safe. And then, when he had been warned by my solicitor, did he not slink away, as he had on the night of the murder, in one of Mr. Rudyard's hired cars to await the news of that young poet's wrongful conviction? If you think that's what may have happened, members of the jury, let us deny Ivan Skelton his final satisfaction and his undeserved wealth. Let us find young Michael Skelton not guilty of the terrible crime of murdering his father. And remember, it is your decision. Here Rumpel glared at the judge, who, sitting motionless, had closed his eyes as though in pain. And not the decision of anyone else in the court. And so the next day we were home again, and sitting on either side of the gas fire at Froxbury Mansions in the evening. Now he said, "Thank you, Hilda. Thank you for the work you put into R. versus Skelton. I'm glad to say there had been no further requests for salad. Rumpole had done full justice to the shepherd's pie and cabbage I had cooked for him, taken with a great deal of mustard and tomato sauce. Some of your ideas were surprisingly helpful." "Only some of them." And when he didn't answer, I said, "I have to say you didn't seem able to follow up some fairly obvious clues. At least not until I got on the case." "I was distracted," Rumpel had to admit. "I was suffering from certain anxieties." "What sort of anxieties, Rumpel?" "Matters of a domestic nature." "You mean you thought it about time we had the kitchen redecorated? I've been thinking that, too." "No. I was concerned." "Well, damn it all, Hilda. I thought you might have grown tired of life here. With me." "Life with you in Froxbury Mansions? Good heavens, how could anyone be tired of that?" "You said... well, anyway, you told me." It was the first time in my entire life I had seen Rumpel stumped for words. "What was all that about Newcomb having taken a shine to you?" "No, I was wrong about that. He hadn't taken a shine to me. He wanted to win me over so I could be his spy." "His what?" I had surprised Rumpel. "So I could spy on you. Tell him if you were getting too near the truth in R. versus Skelton. And there was something else I didn't like him for." "What was that?" "Well, he called me a girl, which I thought was very patronizing. And I know why he gave you the brief." "Well, I do have a certain reputation. Ever since that little problem at the Penge bungalow..." "He thought because you aren't a QC, you wouldn't do the job properly." "That's ridiculous." "Of course it is." There was silence for a while. Rumpel considered my extraordinary suggestion and rejected it. Then he said, "I shan't include R. versus Skelton in my memoirs." "Why ever not? It was one of your greatest triumphs." "No, Hilda." He picked up his brief in a little receiving job at Acton. "The triumph was yours." This is the story that Rumpel will never write. So I'm writing it for you, Dodo, and for you only. It's the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth.